I invite you to turn to Luke chapter 8, and we're going to be focusing really on eight verses and two people. Eight verses and two people. I like the TED Talks. How many of you have ever watched a TED Talk? Can I see your hands? What happens is they bring in some of the best people in the world to talk about a specific thing, and they give them, like 20 or so minutes to talk about it. Well, these talks have had an enormous amount of influence in the world, and as a result, there's a book by Carmine Gallo who speaks to Fortune 500 companies as well as other groups, and he analyzes these speeches and why it is that they're the most effective speeches that have ever been given and why it is that they reach people. Well, his book was called Talk Like TED. And as I was reading his book, Talk Like TED, there was a person that was mentioned in there, and her speech was studied, and her name is Brené Brown. Now, I don't expect any of you know who Brené Brown is, but she is a professor at the University of Houston. So do we have any Cougars out there this morning? All right, not that many. That's all right. But hey, this is for you. This is for you. Here was the thing, you know, she says she was began to be recognized as a storyteller, which as a researcher, she said, just kind of made her go, I don't know that I want that label. But what she was doing is she was doing studies on people. And as she was doing studies, one of the things she said was, she said, and I quote her, I ran into this thing that unraveled connection. Now, so she's studying relationships, but she's studying the things that keep us from making connections or being connected to other people. She said, I ran into this thing that unraveled connection, and it was shame. Shame is understood as the fear of disconnection. And is there something about me that if other people know it or see it, that I won't be worthy of connection? It's shame. So that kind of got me thinking. And I ran into a study, a Lifeway Research did. Many Americans are more worried about their reputation than they are about their conscience. So I'm really concerned about the way that I appear to people, even if my conscience is seared in a way that it shouldn't be. Americans worry less about guilt and fear and worry a whole lot more about avoiding shame. Now, shame has become particularly powerful in American culture because of the internet. And let me tell you what Scott McConnell was pointing out about this. He's the executive director of Lifeway Research. And he said, a single mistake or embarrassing moment posted on social media can now ruin somebody's life. You probably know what he's talking about, right? It's not like there's one example. It's there are tons of examples. So what is it that people are trying to avoid? We're trying to avoid being caught is what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to have... I was thinking about this week. Back in the days when I was playing tennis, one of the guys that was really, you know, popular was Andre Agassi. Anybody remember Andre Agassi? Now, this was before his hairline started to recede, you know, and he had this long, flowy hair, and everybody thought, all the ladies thought he was really good looking, and he hooks up with the Canon Rebel. He becomes kind of the face for Canon Rebel, and he has this phrase, image is everything. The funny thing about Andre Agassi is that means that he was actually ahead of what we're dealing with the internet age, because everything that he said in images, everything captures what everybody's most worried about. We're most worried about image. What's our biggest cultural fear, McConnell goes on to say, is shame. He says, but what's surprising is not that personal freedom or ambition and doing the right thing are valued by Americans. It's that risk to our reputation is what matters the most. So they went on with their study. They wanted to know, and they asked these questions. They asked 1,000 Americans three questions to discover their feelings about fear and shame and guilt and other issues. Here were the questions. Which of these feelings do you seek to avoid the most? Or which of these desires is the strongest in your life? Or which of these directions do you value the most? These were kind of the big picture questions. And overall, most Americans say that they avoid shame the most, and only after that are they really concerned about guilt and or even fear, which is interesting because when you think about guilt, guilt says something to us like this, I deserve to be punished. Whereas shame says something like this, I'm worthless. So if what Americans are actually saying is correct, it really represents what Americans are thinking, then what that means is that most Americans are walking around thinking that they are worthless. What a way to live. The funny thing is if you look at the rest of the world, the rest of the world is trying to say to emulate America. Maybe they want to rethink that. The research shows that people who have a strong sense of shame, they focus on the worst possible outcomes. Let me give you some of the indicators. They're never going to like me. This is never going to work. I'm never going to amount to anything. Have you ever felt anything like that? Have you ever heard anything like that? See, people eaten up with shame, they assume the worst because they think they are the worst. And as a result, they think they deserve the worst. And that's what leads up to the story that I'm going to unpack for you this morning in Luke chapter 8. I'm going to start reading in verse 40. It says, when Jesus returned, and by the way, at this point in his ministry, he's been already performing miracles, starting to get a little bit of a name for himself. By the way, that's what miracles will do for you. It tends to give you a little bit of a name for yourself. People are wanting to go and hear what this guy has to say. And so he returns, and the crowd welcomes him, for they're all expecting him. By the way, how would you be, right? You hear that the miracle worker is coming to your place, and you go, you know, I might have to go check this out. You know, especially if you're sick. Maybe if you're sick, you think, I'm going to go. So he returns, the crowd welcomes him, they're expecting him. And just then, a man named Jairus came. He was a leader of the synagogue, and he fell down at Jesus' feet, and he pleaded with him to come to his house because he had an only daughter about 12 years old, and she was dying. And while he was going, so by the way, that means the answer is, all right, let's do this. And while he was going, the crowds were nearly crushing him. And this is like a rock concert for this guy, right? Now, I want you to think about this first guy that we've been introduced to. His name is Jairus. Who is this guy? Well, he's a well-respected guy. When you think about having, standing in a community, Jairus has got a lot of standing in this community. And the reason we know this is because he holds one of the top positions in that community. It says that he's a ruler of the synagogue. This guy's a big deal, right? He comes walking into the town square, people are going to pay attention. He's a big deal. Grown man, by the way, this is another interesting thing. If you're Jairus, how do you think you're going to approach other people? Well, you're going to approach other people like you're a big deal. You're hot shot. But that's not how he approached Jesus. Did you notice that? He comes up to Jesus and he drops his face to his feet. That isn't what you did back then. It just doesn't work. You know, when you think about falling at someone's feet, really he should have been maybe handling himself a different way. He should have been, wearing his robe. He should have been holding himself upright. Because here's the thing, just like we as Americans are really preoccupied with the way that we look and appearances, and even if our life is falling apart, we want to make sure it doesn't have the appearance of falling apart. Appearances mattered even back then. Jairus should have been walking in and holding himself upright, and instead he falls down to the feet of Jesus. He should have worn his long robe, or even as I was thinking about it, beards are coming back, y'all, but beards were really popular back then. He should have had a beard that would have made the Duck Dynasty guys bow the knee. You know, it's just the how he should have done it. And he walks in and he handles himself a different way. And here's why he handles himself a different way. See, I have four daughters. One of mine is almost 12. And let's imagine, God forbid, that she falls really ill. What do you think I'm going to do? To be totally honest with you, I'm not going to do anything different than what Jairus did. I'm going to go to Jesus and I'm going to beg him to heal her. He does what everybody would do. The good news is Jesus agrees. I mean, if you look at Luke's gospel, that's not what Jesus always does. He goes into some areas and these great throngs of people kind of get around him and they're sick. And it says, and Jesus heals some. And then he walks on. Doesn't always heal everybody. But then here's what happens. And this is what you see in verse 33. It says, a woman suffering from bleeding for 12 years who had spent all she had on doctors and yet she couldn't be healed by any. Hold on right now because I want to talk about her. Here's what this means. When it says that she's been bleeding for 12 years, that basically means that she has had a menstrual flow that has not stopped for 12 years. That's what she's had. So she's sick. She's in pain. It also means that she can't have children. She's also ceremonially unclean. And what that means is then since she had been bleeding for 12 years, that means that she wasn't allowed in a public place for 12 years. That means that she couldn't worship with people for 12 years. She was a social outcast. if she were to come walking into the village and people were to know the condition that she had, she would need to tell them what was going on so that they couldn't touch her, because in touching her, they become unclean. Everybody would part. I mean, it's almost like when you have Jim Carrey doing this with the cars and Bruce Almighty, and they just go voomp like that. That's exactly how people would have been with her. You get anywhere around her and you go the other way. Here's what that also means. It also means that for 12 years, nobody touches her. It means that for 12 years, nobody gives her a hug. Luke, by the way, who was a doctor, the one that wrote this, he adds that according to the doctors, they thought that she was incurable. So she's gone to the best that they had, and there was nothing that they could do. The other thing is she's also broke. And the reason she's broke is because she kept going to doctors to see if there was a way that they could cure her. So she's not going to be healed. She has no money, and nobody's willing to get around her. Two people, do you see them now? You have Jairus. Jairus is the guy that everybody respects. He's a man of standing in the community. And then you have this woman. By the way, we don't even know her name. Who is she? We're not sure. That's how far gone she was to everybody then. Both of them could have had some things that would have kept them from coming to Jesus, though, if you think about it. For Jairus, it could have been pride, right? I mean, this is a guy of means and position, and let's make sure that we maintain the status quo with what that means. I'm going to look strong. But for her, you know what it probably would have been that would have kept her from coming to Jesus? Is shame. It's just shame. Not because of anything that she had done, by the way. I mean, it's not like she's sitting there saying, you know, I really wish this illness on myself, and then she becomes ill. It's not like that. By the way, nowadays you can think of another way of connecting it. It's no different when people feel shame because they've been abused and mistreated. A lot of times you have the victim is sitting there feeling ashamed because they were victimized. This lady, because of cultural circumstances, became a victim not just to her health, but to the way that people treat people with the condition that she has. And they didn't want to have anything to do with her. But what does she do? She doesn't respond by giving in to shame. She, second, doesn't respond by giving in to what society expects from her or what a culture demands from her, because she knew that there was a place that she could go for healing and be to put back together. You remember what Brené Brown said, the researcher from the University of Houston, for all 10 of you that went there? Hey, I'm the one that said, do we have any cougars out there? And you're like, meh. Do you remember what she said? She said, is there something about me that if other people know it or see it, that I won't be worthy of connection? Do you think that she felt this yet? How about you walk around without getting a hug or affection for 12 years and see how you feel? I guess she was there. But instead, we get this from her in verse 44. She approaches Jesus from behind, and she touched the end of his robe, and instantly she is healed. Now, by the way, I always had this picture as a kid, you know, and I'm reading this story that, you know, she's kind of in the crowd, you know, and she sort of reaches out from between people and touches the robe, and it's nothing like that at all. Instead, she grabs it. She grabs it like a rope when he walks by and pulls it. That's the way she reacts to this. It's interesting because Mark's gospel says that she had heard about Jesus. Where'd she hear it? It's not like she's hanging out in the synagogue. She can't worship there. Where's she hearing all of this stuff? But she did. Don't know where, but she hears it and she comes in. Maybe it's because of something like Malachi 4:2, where it says that the Messiah would be so powerful that even the wing of his garment will bring healing. And here she is walking through the crowd. And what is she looking for? I just need the hem of the garment. He's what I need. But here's the catch. She's not supposed to be there in the first place. I want you to think about this for just a second this morning. And this all has to do with the way that people view church. For some people, they look at what's inside of them, maybe the choices that they've made, and they say, church is not the place for me. And the reason that they say that church is not the place for them is because there is some sense of shame over the choices that they've made. And what they respond to in their shame isn't going to the Savior. Instead, it's allowing their circumstances to overwhelm them, to keep them from getting to the place where they could find healing to begin with. I don't deserve the connection, and so I'm not going to go. Now, that's one way of looking at church. Let me tell you another way of looking at church. Church is the place that you go instead of saying, I'm going to get my life together and then I'm going to go to church. Church is the place that you go so that you have people and you have the Lord that help you get your life together. That's what it's supposed to be for. And so Jesus, what does he do? He responds, who touched me? Now, why did he ask that? Why ask that? I think I have an idea. Do you remember back in Genesis chapter 3, you have the fall of Adam and Eve. They choose the forbidden fruit, right? And after they choose the forbidden fruit, they walk away in shame. They don't want God to find them. And so they kind of sneak away. They're hiding in the shrubs like that was going to work. You know, but they're hiding in the shrubs, right? And it says that he comes into the garden as he's looking for them. And what does God say? Where are you? Where are you? Now, does God not know? I don't think that's it. Instead, it's an opportunity for the person to step out and to see him again. It's a moment where we can own it. By the way, Peter was absolutely no use to Jesus. He's like, who touched me? And Peter's like, well, master, the crowds are hemming you in and they're pressing in all around you. Oh my gosh. You know, this guy. I mean, at this point, he's like, this is the team that I have to work with, right? Does anybody else have an idea? What does Jesus do? This is where I want to pick up in verse 46. He said, someone touched me, and I know that the power has gone out from me. And when the woman saw that she was discovered, she came trembling and she fell down before him. Do you want to know why? It's because she was scared. She was scared. If you're not supposed to be there, and people figure out you're not supposed to be there, you might be scared of what the people are going to do to you. And in the presence of all the people, and this is why I love this lady, in the presence of all the people, she declared the reason she had touched him. A lot of those people don't even know. But what does she do? In spite of a situation that because of public humiliation, she could have said, I'm keeping this inside of myself because it is so embarrassing. What does she do? I came to him because I needed healing, and this is what he healed me from. Can I make a suggestion to you this morning? Because with her, she reaches out in faith. And the result of her reaching out in faith to Jesus is this. Jesus looks at her and he says, daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. She reaches out to him. There was a lot in the crowd, by the way, that they were there because they were just curious. I just want to see what the show is about. I want to see somebody that sick get healed because you know what? That's got to be cool to see. By the way, totally agree. It's got to be cool to see. But those aren't the people that are reaching out in faith. They just want their curiosity satisfied. This woman wasn't looking just for healing for her body. She was looking for healing in her soul. She reaches out to him. And Jesus calls her daughter. What has everybody else called her for 12 years? Daughter. By the way, I have four daughters. You've probably figured that out. Luke is my favorite gospel. If we had had a son, I was going to name my son Luke. That's the most unused name in our house, by the way. I have four daughters. All four of my daughters have a nickname. And the reason that, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but they have a special name that each of them have that I have given them in virtue of the uniqueness of my relationship with them. That nickname means something. Jesus looks at her and calls her a daughter. So here's how we're like her. Jesus is within eyeshot of you, and you're hiding in the crowd, maybe because of shame. I don't want him to know. I don't want anybody to know. That's one path that you can take. The problem with that path is there's no healing in it. What you've done is bought into what Brené Brown was talking about before, is when we get to a place that we're so caught up in our shame that we're unwilling to make connections because we see that we're undeserving of those connections. Maybe that's where you're at. But Brené Brown says that the only answer to this is not to give in to your shame, it's to speak to your shame. Don't let it have the power over you. In this case, can I make a connection? It's not just that you need to speak to your shame, you need to speak to your sin. You need to speak to your sin. Timothy Paul Jones, he's pretty well-known speaker. He's written a number of books. He shared this story, and I want to end by sharing it with you. And I hope this makes this connect to you. He said, "I never dreamed that taking a child to Disney World could be so difficult." I'm like, "Are you kidding me? I never dreamed that taking a child could be so difficult, or that such a trip could teach me so much about God's outrageous grace." Our middle daughter had been previously adopted by another family. He said, I'm sure this couple had the best of intentions, but they never quite integrated the adopted child into their family of biological children. After a couple of rough years, they dissolved the adoption, and we ended up welcoming an 8-year-old girl into our home. For one reason or another, whenever our daughter's previous family vacationed at Disney World, they took their biological children with them, but they left her with someone else. Usually, at least in the child's mind, this happened because she did something wrong that precluded her presence on the trip. And so by the time we adopted our daughter, she had seen many pictures of Disney World, and she had heard about the rides and the characters and the parades. But when it came to passing through the gates of the Magic Kingdom, she had always seen the one left on the outside. And once I found out about this history, I made plans to take her to Disney World the next time a speaking engagement took our family to that area. I thought I had mastered the Disney World drill. I knew from previous experiences that the prospect of seeing cast members in freakishly oversized mouse and duck costumes somehow turns children into squirming bundles of emotional instability. What I didn't expect was that the prospect of visiting this dream world would produce a stream of downright devilish behavior in our newest daughter. In the month leading up to our trip to the Magic Kingdom, she stole food when a simple request would have gained her a snack. She lied when it would have been easier to tell the truth. She whispered insults that were carefully crafted to hurt her older sister as deeply as possible. And as the days on the calendar moved closer to the trip, her mutinies multiplied. A couple of days before our family headed to Florida, I pulled our daughter into my lap to talk through her latest escapade. "I know what you're going to say," she said. "You're not going to take me to Disney World, are you?" The thought, he said, actually hadn't crossed my mind. But her downward spiral suddenly started to make some sense. She knew she couldn't earn her way to the Magic Kingdom. She had tried and failed that test several times before. So she was living in a way that pleased as far that placed her as far as possible from the most magical place on earth. In retrospect, he said, "I'm embarrassed to admit that in that moment, I was tempted to turn her fear to my own advantage." Parents, you know what he's about to do, or at least suggest. The easiest response would have been, "You don't start acting better, you don't get to go." He said, "But by God's grace, I didn't do it. Instead, I asked her this question: is this trip something that we're doing as a family?" And she nodded her head yes, but she started to cry. He said, "And are you a part of this family?" And she nodded her head yes. He said, "Well, then you're going with us. Sure, there may be some consequences to help you remember what's right and what's wrong, but you're a part of this family, and we're not leaving you behind." He goes on to say, I'd like to say that her behaviors grew better after that moment, and they didn't. You were hoping that that would be the end of the story right there. Right? And everybody's happy. Hold on. Her choices pretty much spiraled out of control at every hotel and rest stop all the way to Lake Buena Vista, right? And you're sitting there going, this is the best story of all time, right? Still, we headed to Disney World on the day that we had promised, and it was a typical Disney day. This is the part where you can say your amens. Overpriced tickets, overpriced meals, lots of lines mingled with just enough manufactured magic that makes us consider coming back again. But he goes on to say this: in our hotel room that evening, a very different child emerged. She was exhausted, pensive, a little weepy at times, but her month-long facade of rebellion had gone away. And when bedtime rolled around, I prayed with her, and I held her, and I asked her, "So how was your first day at Disney World?" And she closed her eyes and she put her head down in her unicorn. And after a few moments, she opened her eyes just a little bit and she said, "Daddy, I finally got to go to Disney World. But it wasn't because I was good. It's because I'm yours. It wasn't because I'm good. It's because I'm yours." That is the message of outrageous grace. Outrageous grace isn't a favor that you achieve by doing good. It's the gift that you receive by being God's. That's Easter. That's Easter. I have prayed for all of you this week. To be honest with you, I've prayed for myself. What I had hoped is that for some of you that you say, you know, years ago, I made this decision to follow Jesus. I'm going to ask you a very simple question this morning. Are you really following Jesus? Are you really? I just want you to answer that for yourself. I think on a day like today, he deserves this. But for others of you, can I tell you what I've prayed for you? I've prayed that you would find the message in the Disney story. This is the story of outrageous grace. And we come to him not because we've earned it, but because he loves us. I've wanted you to find that kind of love. And so I just want to lead us in a time of prayer. I ask you just for a moment, please bow your heads. It's just to remove any distractions. That's it. You're here, and this is a good thing. Let's put the world aside for a second. And maybe you're sitting here this morning, and you've never made this decision to follow Jesus. Let today be the day. And if you're ready, I ask you, and I invite you, to pray with me. Father, I know that I'm a sinner. And I know that because of my sin, it's broken my relationship with you. But I'm coming to you today and I'm asking you, Lord, by your grace and your mercy, to forgive me. I accept that I'm in need of your forgiveness. And I accept that there's no other way that I can come to you except through Jesus. No work that I can do. Nothing that I could earn, but by your grace and your kindness, and I accept it today. I pray that you would begin this work in my heart to change what is inside of me, and much like the woman in this story in Luke 8, that you would make me new and clean. I just want to say, if you prayed that with me this morning, here's what I think. I think that you are saved. And what that means is, at least according to the Bible, it means that Jesus has taken you from a state of ruin and he has given you a whole new place in life. But your journey has only just begun. And here's the beautiful thing about being here. We're ready to walk this journey with you. We're ready to walk this journey with you. It's what it means to be a part of a church where, much like this woman, she stands in front of a group and she just talks. Everybody needs that. There is freedom and power in the forgiveness of Jesus Christ.